Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. This week, because everyone's away at the Monaco Yacht Show, we have an interview for you instead. It's with Carl Allen, the owner of the 50-metre Westport Gigi and the 55-metre support boat Axis. But he's not just a superyacht owner, he's also a treasure hunter, and he has discovered one of the richest treasure ships in history. As well as bringing up emeralds, gold, swords and cannon from the ocean floor, he's also built a museum in the Bahamas to house it all. He's also the owner of the nearby island Walker's Quay, which he is developing back into one of the most special sport fishing locations in the world. Without further ado, here is my interview with Carl Allen. So Carl, thanks for joining the Boat Briefing podcast. It looks like you're on your Westport Gigi right now.
Yes, sir, we are. We're out at the site here, and it's if we cut off, we got some major storms coming here this afternoon, so it's pretty ugly right now.
So you mentioned the weather might be turning, so it's getting a bit dodgy.
Yeah, we've been out here a few days, and just at night it gets calm, and then during the day it just plows these storms coming over from Florida.
And so what does that do to, I mean, that you can't obviously dive and, you know, look for more wreckage or treasure. You've got to go to shore.
Yeah, it's very frustrating, the weather. Mother Nature actually decides whether we do this or not, but we're limited to about 12 knots of wind. And out here, because we're so exposed, the currents have an effect. If you get wind fighting currents, you get these big curly waves, and it just shuts down. It becomes dangerous, and we've got to get everybody out of the water.
And has that happened a lot in the last kind of few months?
It happens all the time. Yes, we just get hit by these storms one after another, or just the wind. Sometimes it's just a wind, no rain or anything, just wind.
Okay. Well, we should probably give some context to what we're talking about, of course, and that is the fact that you have found one of the greatest sunken treasures in history.
Well, we found part of it, and we are following this debris field for the last 3 years now, and have been very successful. We found some amazing things.
And so how long have you actually been looking for this particular wreck site?
Well, as an operation, about 3 years now. We found some stuff right before Dorian in 19, and then we had to shut that whole operation down, and we started helping the country. But we got a real solid 2020 and a real solid 2021, and we've had a tough year this year with the weather. It's been blowing, seems like, since January.
And so, Carl, I'm going to definitely get the name of the ship wrong, because I do every time. But it's the Maravillas. Is that roughly right?
Yes. In Spanish, it's the Nuestra Señora de las Maravillas, which translates to Our Lady of Wonders in English.
And I wonder if you wouldn't mind just giving us a quick potted history of the Maravillas and how it came to be at the bottom of the sea in the Bahamas.
Yeah, absolutely. The quick history was it was part of the Terra Firma fleet in the Spanish when they were ruling the world back in the 1600s. And the ship fleet was sent over here in 1654. It was supposed to come right back, and due to a number of things, they got delayed. And then finally, in January of 1656, the fleet took off out of Cuba, out of Havana, and they headed north. And it wasn't a hurricane, because it was out of season, but they got hit by a pretty good-sized northeaster. And the whole fleet got confused, and the Maravilla, which was actually the Admiralita, the ship in the rear, collided with the Capitana, the lead ship, and the lead ship basically split the Maravilla in half. And part of it sunk, we believe, right where I am, and part of it may have bobbled off somewhere into the abyss, and we've been looking for that section as well.
And so how, I mean, this was in the age of when Spanish treasure ships were basically sucking gold and rare gems and all sorts out of South America and sending them back to the homeland, basically. So can you give us, do you roughly know what was on board at the time that she went down?
Well, we've seen parts of the manifest. But I certainly can't tell you everything. And one thing about the ships back then is, you know, up to 200% of the manifest was actually contraband. That the Maravilla had 650 souls on it. And, you know, you really didn't have your own safety deposit box or a bank or anything. So you carried with you what you owned, or you hid it somewhere. And then people would hide silver and gold all over the ship and, you know, try and get by the taxes that the king had set up once it was back in Spain. So it's very interesting that this is probably one of the largest treasure fleets that ever had left the New World at that time.
And so those 650 people, were they a lot of them were sailors, obviously, but were others just civilians going home?
Well, it was a whole group of folks. Yes, there was some military. There was some, we believe there was royalty on board, clergy, of course. A ship like that, it was a 900-ton vessel, would have held about, we're going to guess about 150 of the 650 were passengers, and the rest were either royalty or military or working for the government in some form. So, but she did carry quite a few passengers as well, and of course they all had, you know, their own possessions. So it's interesting that we believe we found quite a few of those possessions from individuals.
And is it even possible to put a number or a rough number on the value of what she was holding?
You know, it's tricky. The lawyers and the archaeologists kind of tell you to stay away from that. But, you know, I will tell you that it's if you know about the Atocha, you know, the Atocha was a 358-ton ship, I believe. So the Mirabia would have been more than twice as big. And at the time, in 1986, when the Atocha was found, 1985, that it was valued at $400 million back then. So it's very possible that a ship like this could go, you know, much higher than that.
Wow. And so some of the finds you've been pulling up, how have you linked them to the Mirabias? How have you made that connection to absolutely determine that these are objects that went down with that particular ship?
Well, there's really three things that got us really excited. One of them was in 2020, we found the handle guard of a sword. And the commander of the fleet, Mr. Guzman, his name was on it. And so we knew instantly that we were on the Mirabia from records in Spain. Secondly, we found a large 70-pound silver bar that had markings on it, had the assayer, had all the purity markings, and had the owner's markings. And we were able to match that with another bar that was confirmed off the Mirabia. So that was our second piece of evidence. What I like to say, too, is that, you know, we have not found any coinage after, you know, I think we're up to almost 4,000 silver coins. We have not found one coin older than 1655. And the ship went down in 1656. So. And then again, Spain, the record of the Indies, the Museum of the Indies in Sevilla, you know, doesn't really have another Spanish ship sinking right here. And so that's another, you know, sort of a process of elimination in a lot of ways to determine that we're on the right ship. And, you know, we found a lot of valuable stuff, but the stuff that we find that connects us to the wreck, that's what really gets me excited.
Yeah. Yeah. It must. I mean, especially after kind of looking and searching for so long. Because it's this particular wreck you've had your eye on for quite some time, isn't it?
Well, I mean, we've been looking for it for 3 years, but I've been thinking about it for probably half my life, if not more. I did meet Mel Fisher when I was a young man and, you know, gave me the disease. And I asked him, you know, what ships he would look for. And he immediately mentioned the Mirabias. And what's neat is, you know, I grew up going to Stuart, Florida. I own Walker's Cay in the Bahamas, and the wreck is literally right in the middle. And it's on this, we are on this parallel that's the 27th parallel. There's something in there. I don't know. It's weird.
So Mel Fisher was obviously a huge influence on you. But, I mean, was it that meeting that kind of sparked this fascination? Or was there generally a kind of that kind of boyhood fantasy island kind of thing of digging up, you know, buried treasure and all that kind of stuff? Was it there already, or was it really the Mel Fisher meeting that sparked it?
I'm sure there was a little bit there, but, you know, I got certified as a diver when I was 16 in a quarry in Wisconsin. And so I'd never been to saltwater till I had met Mel. And so I guess it was a little bit of that combination of, you know, getting to know the ocean, not having a dry suit on, and then going through his museum. And then I literally almost thought about going to work for him because he was looking for divers. And thank God I didn't, because, you know, I was able to come back in life and do it the right way. But it was very tempting in the beginning to, you know, go to work for them. And I did this sort of amateurishly when I owned yachts. And we looked in Puerto Rico. I've looked in the Keys. But what it was really neat to turn pro about 5 years ago when I sold my company and we, you know, pretty much do this full time.
And so as well as the Westport Gigi, I mean, you literally have all the tools you could possibly imagine for a treasure hunt in the Bahamas. You have a Darman support vessel, you've got seaplanes, you've got submarines, you've got 50 meter Westport, obviously. I mean, it is the complete package, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it started with that. I had to build this fleet before we even, you know, decided to make this a business. But we had sold the company. It was my wife's birthday that year, 24th of September. And I went out and I had known about Westport my whole life and loved the boats. I loved the 164. And I literally bought the boat unseen. A lot of people I know had seen it. And gave it to my wife on her birthday. We named it after her. And I think she thought maybe that was it. And the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show came that year. And I literally walked up to the Damon without even getting on it. And I said, that's what we need. And it was packed with people. And met Rose Damon and her team. And that buying the Axis was really the key to turning this thing into a professional business. She's a mothership, you know, she handles all the fuel, all the water, fills tanks, security, safety, got a great crew on there. And it's really the mothership of what we do out here. Gigi's sort of my home, but the Axis is running all these little boats. Because we, at any given time, you know, we have 6 or 7 boats out here doing this, up to 40 people in the water.
And it's a hell of a team, isn't it? So how do you even begin to assemble a team like that to you know, for your mission as Allen Explorations?
Well, I started from the beginning and I knew I needed experienced crew. And the Gigi fortunately had a crew that stayed with us. We still have a few of them. And the one main one is now our captain, and his wife is our chief stewardess. And so it's about the people. I mean, the boats kind of do what they say they do, and you can fix them if they break. But people, you know, if this is hard, what we do, it's tedious, it's dangerous. You get tired. We have to do their regular jobs while they're doing the salvaging. And so it takes a group of special people. We know pretty quick if you fit in or not. But the one thing I'm very proud of is about 80% of the divers that we do have are Bahamian kids. And we're got a team of them out here diving with us. They're all trained, you know, in safety and security and how to, you know, archaeologically dive for salvage. And it's a really neat thing when you see these kids. We almost have like a, you know, you almost have a school out here teaching archaeology to these kids. It's wonderful.
And that's a key part of it, isn't it? So this isn't you out there trying to bring up treasure to get rich. It's you trying to bring up treasure to advance our understanding of history. And because a lot of it will be donated to a local museum that you've established.
Yeah, I don't recommend getting into this type of business if you want to get rich. This is a very difficult thing. It took me many years to get to where we are with the government. We're the only license holder, I think, right now, and certainly in the Bahamas and maybe even the whole Caribbean. But it's something that, you know, I came into this with a lot of resources. I don't need the money. Very proud to say over 14,000 artifacts have been salvaged and not one pottery shard has left this country, nor will it. And yes, we just recently opened up a museum in Lucaya, and it was a wonderful event. I actually had 2 prime ministers from the opposing political parties there cutting the ribbon with us. It was a magical day that we rose above politics and really did something good for the country. It's more than just a shipwreck museum. It's a whole maritime museum with a history of the natural history, the Lucayans, which is very important to the Bahamians, slave ship, obviously important to the Bahamians, and then, of course, a whole display of what we've come up with the Maravilla and how that works. And love to have people there. It's free for Bahamians for the first 2 months, always free for kids. And you know, we're open for business right now. We're still building it, but there's a lot to see there. It's really, really interesting.
And the artifacts that you're bringing up, are you yourself? You're obviously a keen diver as well. Are you down there with the suction kind of pump, moving the sand around and finding things on the seafloor?
A little bit there, but yes, you know, I think it's a big thing that my wife and I both get down into the water, that our crew sees that, and they know how, you know, passionate we are about that. And that passion spreads throughout the organization. We have meetings every night after the dive, talk about what happened during the day, plan out the next day, look at the weather. And it's one of these things where I found very little. I think I found a few coins and an emerald, but to see somebody come up with a gold chain or a pendant or a bunch of emeralds or something, it doesn't matter who found it. We all share that moment, and we've had a bunch of those.
Yeah, the chain was spectacular. That was an image that got quite a lot of attention in the press and on social media. I mean, can you describe that moment when one of your team brings up something of that size?
Well, unfortunately, and this is kind of happens a lot, but I had just left the site. We went back to Florida, and I get back to Stewart, and my phone just starts lighting up, and I'm like, you're kidding me. And I saw these two people, this guy, Andy, and another gentleman, Kinton, two of our veterans out here. And I mean, to see two grown men hugging and kissing and jumping up and down, it's incredible. Yeah, I've been out here for a couple of neat finds. My wife found a really neat pendant a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I can't even breathe when I look at it. You start thinking about the history and where it came from and who made it and where it was going. I mean, some of this stuff was probably going to the king of Spain. And so some very interesting moments, yes.
Amazing. Is it just literally, practically just a case of following this trail of kind of rubies and emeralds and gold chains and things across the sea floor until you find the mother load, or is it just little bits and pieces scattered all over the place?
Well, this ship was a lot like the Tocha. And, you know, if you look back at Mel's history there, he found it, part of it in, you know, the early 70s. And he didn't find the mother load, which was 7 miles away, until 1985, 15 years later. And, of course, lost his son and his daughter-in-law, and they had another tragedy. And I certainly don't hope that I take that long, but Kim Fisher, who I'm very good friends with, tells me, just keep following the trail. Even if it's just a piece of pottery or a musket ball, just as long as you keep finding stuff, you're on it. And although this sits in 40 foot of water, it could be 3 to 20 foot of sand that's underneath. And so we have these boats called blow boats. We call them mailbox boats, and they blow that sand out. And then we're able to get down in those holes, those craters. We're not hurting anything because it's just sand and an extinct reef. And then we go down with handbell detectors, and it doesn't pick up the non-ferrous materials from a magnetometer, but with the handheld mag, you can pick up the gold and the silver, and that's kind of how we do it. And it's not easy. I mean, we've dug, I think, 8,000 holes in 3 years. We're out here right now. We've had 9 days of nothing.
And oh, really?
Until this morning. We found 7 coins this morning, so we're back on the trail. And unfortunately, Mother Nature is going to blow us out of here this afternoon. And there's a hurricane on the horizon, and so, you know, who knows? It's going to drive me crazy, the weather.
And I suppose every time a hurricane blows through, it kind of disturbs the seafloor. So it's almost like starting again. Is that more or less true?
You know, that's a very arguable point. We sit here and we talk about what hurricanes do. We think it could be bad because it covers it way up again, or good as it uncovers it. So The bad news is, like when Dorian hit, for instance, I didn't get back to the site for 9 months, and for one or the other. And that's really, because now that we've got, you know, some establishment on walkers, we've got the museum open, we're out here digging, I don't need a hurricane. And that's, we, this time of year, we're paranoid, all of us. And, you know, right now, a little bit nervous, but all this latest one, Fiona, I think it is starting to track up towards the north. So that's good, great news here.
So it's an emotional roller coaster, if you pardon the cliche. I mean, you're up and you're down, then the weather strikes, then you don't find anything for 9 days, and you pull up 7 gold coins, and everyone's on a high again. So it must be, yeah.
Well, those were silver coins, but yes, I wish they were silver coins, but it is. I mean, you know, it takes a special kind of person, a special group of people to do this, because it of that. The government, the people, the equipment, the weather, everything has to come together. So figure 1 month out of the year, we're out here doing this. It's just crazy. If I had more time, I think we would get closer to this mother load. I just need more time.
Yeah. But having a base at Walker's Quay not too far away is obviously quite beneficial. And so many people might not know that you bought the island a couple of years ago, right? 2000, pre-COVID, obviously, about 2017. Was that about
Yeah,
right?
We bought in 2018 pre-Dorian. And, I thought that Dorian was kind of the end of the world out there. But then we fixed that, helped Little Grand big time. And then here comes the pandemic. And that, I'll give a lot of credit to the previous prime minister. It didn't affect him too much getting sick because he shut things down. But this is a country that the economy's based on, 80% of it's based on tourism. And it literally shut this country down for a year and a half. It's just now starting to come back. We've seen the cruise ships coming back in, Americans starting a little bit to come back into the country, and the smaller yachts and stuff. But it was, when it's bad in Florida, you might as well be in Mars over here. It's been bad. But this is a country that they stick together. They are some of the toughest people that I know in the world, that what they've been through down here. They help each other big time. There's big, big families here. And no matter what you seem to throw at these people, they seem to find a way over it.
Yeah. And actually, I just wanted to ask a question that it's always interests me when it comes to finding artifacts like yours. I mean, how do you protect it? Do you have to keep the location secret? I mean, presumably people can find GG on AIS. So if you were really interested, you could kind of see where you guys have been. But I mean, how do you make sure no one comes along and ruins what you've discovered?
Well, that's a great question, Stuart. I mean, number one, everybody kind of knows where we're at. I mean, we're on a direct path to Florida here, but you know, I've said this before, I almost welcome them. This stuff is so hard to find. Hey, come help us, you know. But really what protects us is Mother Nature and the sand, because it's a real, you know, elaborate operation what we're doing here, that if you don't have all these blow boats and you got to set them up and try anchor them and all that stuff, we're obvious what we're doing. And so I say, yeah, Mother Nature and there's supposed to be a story of a Russian satellite that downed out here that's also protecting the wreck, but we haven't found that yet. But not really. You know, it seems like the old days, they used to have a little more problem with piracy and stuff, but we do have a partnership. As a matter of fact, the BDF is out here with us always. They don't have a ship, but they have two members of their dive team that are always with us. There's a base about 30 miles from here that they could be out here in no time. They do visit us on occasion. So no, I'm pretty sure we're safe. Our security at our museum is over the top. And again, I would hope that people respect the treasure like I do. It's here for the Bahamians, and it's not going anywhere.
I think that's the point, isn't it? I mean, if you were some wealthy outsider come to take a lot of treasure off the seafloor and stick it in a bank somewhere, that would be... Yeah, I think people might have quite an adverse reaction to that. But since everything you find is staying in the Bahamas, it's quite a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was real important to me with the government for them to know that, because, you know, my predecessors had partners. And when you have partners in a deal, you know, they become the priority. My wife and I, we do not have partners. And so we don't have that problem. And as a matter of fact, Stuart, we've gone a little above and beyond. I've purchased almost $1 million collection from a gentleman that was here in the 70s that we brought back. I purchased another collection close to 100,000 that we brought back just recently. So two collectors. And then we found an astrolabe that was partially owned by the government that we brought back. And also we're in talks with another gentleman to bring more of it back. So I think I proved to the government that, you know, not only is it staying here, but by bringing additional collections back, that they know how serious I am, and they have trust in me, which is, believe me, an obligation that I know that I have. Huge.
Yeah, they must. Yeah. They must appreciate your intentions are pure. And so in terms of what has been discovered, would you say the chain is the most spectacular of objects?
No. We have a emerald brooch. It's a 21 carat cabochon emerald that's set in gold, surrounded by 12, roughly 2 carat emeralds that's surrounded on both sides with a small cross called the Knights of Santiago or the St. James cross on both sides. And that piece was found roughly the same hole as the gold chain. And it stunned our archaeologists. They did not believe that they were making that quality of jewelry that soon, especially in Colombia. So it already changed the thinking there. But emeralds, typically, they are flawed, and it's generally accepted, and some flaws are good. This cabochon is almost flawless. There's only one or two little dots on it. No one has ever seen this type of emerald before. And so it's small. It's about that big. It's one of the centerpieces in the museum. It is displayed. But I don't even know. You couldn't even talk about price because it's that unique. And that's kind of our main piece. But also some neat stuff. We found a bezoar stone that is actually functional. It's a little golden heart with a hairball of a camel, believe it or not, that's balled up in there. And it's functional because the typical way that royalty or monarchy was assassinated back then was poison. And it was either arsenic or hemlock. And this stone, if you dipped it in wine or water or whatever, even milk, the stone would go from black to white, and it would tell that monarch, hey, this is poisoned. And so it wears it on their neck. And it's one of the reasons we believe royalty was on this ship, which becomes extraordinarily exciting.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? Oh, what a thing to discover. And I just think, Carl, you're out there, you're not keeping any of this treasure. You're out there spending an absolute fortune running a fleet of boats. So it slightly feels like this is, it's clear that this is very close to your heart and you're enormously passionate about it. Do you think this is what you're called to do in a way? You were very successful in business, but this is what you're kind of put on this planet to do?
I think there was definitely something there. I mean, my wife and I, after I sold the company, really, looked at each other. We're pretty young at that point and decided, hey, this must be something to pursue. We kind of did it amateurishly when I had an old yacht and I found some stuff in Puerto Rico one time and I brought my kids down there and they're like, geez, Dad, what are we doing? I'm like, keep quiet, kid, keep digging, And we would find some pretty neat stuff. But I never thought I'd sell my company. I had 1,500 of my best friends working for me and we were successful. And then my biggest competitor came along and offered me something I couldn't refuse. And I had that twinkle that, oh my gosh, I might be able to do this and follow in people like Mel Fisher's footsteps and make a name for myself and my family and our company. And I love the islands. I love Stuart, Florida, where I grew up. Obviously, Walker's 27th parallel here. It's a great life. It's hard. Don't get me wrong. We suffer a lot, but I'm blessed that we are doing this. It's a wonderful thing.
And actually, we should talk about Walker's a bit more since you mentioned it as well, because that is a massive undertaking. This was the mecca of sport fishing in the Bahamas, but the island was abandoned effectively until you brought it, and you've kind of reinvigorated it. You've built slips. You've completely rehabilitated it. So, how's that project progressing?
So it's going good. I'm 58 last month, and I first saw Walker's when I was 12, coming over the Gulf Stream and over the banks, and it was the first island I saw. And when we got there, I remember running down the runway, and everybody'd always talk about the planes that crashed there and how good the fishing was. And you're talking about a 12-year-old boy that had never even seen saltwater And all of a sudden, I'm standing on Walker's Cay. And it probably ruined me in school, because after that, I would stare out the window thinking about the damn country and Walker's. But my stepdad, who passed away a few years ago, I bought it just after he died. And he knew someday that if I had the resources that I was going to buy Walker's. I mean, it is absolutely the fishing mecca. We still hold a bunch of the world records. My famous saying is it's where the bonefish meet the billfish. We have incredible backcountry fishing, seasonal on the offshore fishing, which can be dynamic. Had a couple of great tournaments there. Our last one, we released 74 billfish, almost $1 million in prizes. And it sat dormant after Janine and Francis in 04. You know, my kids just kind of remember Walker's as a rock. I remember Walker's as, you know, one of the most iconic fishing destinations there ever was. And to be the one to try at this point to bring Walker's back has definitely been a dream of mine. Never thought that my family would be doing this, but the people all across the East Coast just love Walker's. And what keeps me going is the people on social media that are just egging me on and Mr. Allen, you're doing wonderful things, and patting me on the back and to get people to come out and see what we've done. We've got a whole new marina. We've got fuel. We've got incredible water out there. The island is sort of in its natural state. My wife and I walk around it every day. 16 cottages. We're going to be there, probably be functional by the first quarter next year. We've got a restaurant being built and a church is done. So if you have a boat with somewhere to stay, please come. We're $5 a foot, all included right now. And we've got customs. We've got immigrations there. And, you know, you'll probably feel the same way as I did when I was 12 when you come.
And how much is left to be done? I mean, I've seen the photos and it looks, the marina looks complete. What, on land side, is there much more development to come?
That's a good question. And you know, with all that's happened with the storm and the pandemic and the supply chain and prices and lead times, I won't lie, it's had a major effect on our plans. We are looking at phase one, it's everything I just described. You know, phase two is some additional cottages. I have to pay a lot of attention to the center console market because it's so big, and we're one of the closest islands to Florida.
So big. Yeah.
So we're looking at building, you know, some lesser expensive homes on the end of the island for guys and women that just want to come and have a air-conditioned, clean room with maybe a little kitchenette and something that won't be too expensive, and you just want to come and do some fishing. And, you know, that's the kind of people that we want to have. You know, that's the kind of people I remember when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, it's really exciting, particularly because the boat, I mean, the island was dead, basically, wasn't it, until you brought it back to life. But yeah, it's been a few years of a few challenges.
Yes, absolutely. It was just a rock. There was a power company on there because I actually have a generator that supplies power to Little Grand. It's 500 Bahamians, about 7 miles away. But other than that, the marina was destroyed. The runway was functional, but not in very good shape. So I'm very proud to say that the runway is usable. The marina is in excellent shape. And again, we've got a bunch of diesel, gasoline. People rave about our water out there because we don't pull it out of the ocean. We've got several wells there, and we just have to pull the salt water out of it. But she's slowly coming back, Stuart.
And it sounds like the sportfish community has really responded. So there's a lot of excitement in that community about what you're doing there.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's really my bailiwick is that, you know, we've had Greg Norman out there. We've had Michael Jordan, Dustin Johnson. I think I've met 6 billionaires because of Walker's. It's really a special place. And then the history of the people that have come there. I mean, the weddings that went on, the children that were conceived. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. I've got a pack of people over in Florida that they just can't wait to come back and sit at a bar and remember the what Walkers used to be like.
Yeah, it sounds pretty special to me. So say, for instance, in the next year or so, you do find the motherlode of the Maravillas, and that's it. It's a massive moment in underwater archaeology. I mean, have you got your eye on any other wrecks in the Bahamas?
Oh, yeah. We have an area of the Bahamas. We only have about 0.5% geographically, but I believe we've got some key areas. And there's a ship called the Madonna de Brazil that actually salvaged part of the Maravilla in 1657, a year after she sunk. And then she got about 150 miles away at a little island called Gorda Key, which is where Disney is, and sunk again. And so we're very interested in that ship. We've been down there. We've found some debris. We found some coins. And so that's number two on my list. Number three is a ship that's not far from here called the Genovesa that could be one of the oldest ships ever found in the Western Hemisphere. We've located some coins that go back to the mid-1500s. My other thing is, and I won't let too much out of the bag here, but I got my eye on a German submarine that we believe is not far from here that we would need our submarine to go look at. And we believe that it's there. And I'm working on getting some permits to go see if we can find it. Think of this. There's 3 million shipwrecks plus in the world. If the Spanish lost one ship a year in the Bahamas, there'd be 350 of them here. We knew there was years they lost dozens. So the fact is there's thousands of wrecks here. Not all of them are treasure ships, but every one of them is historical. And so we intend to look for a couple ships that aren't very valuable, you know, from a treasure standpoint, but could be extremely valuable historically here in the Bahamas. One of them possibly being a slave ship, and only one slave ship has ever been found before now.
So there is no shortage of things to keep you busy on the seafloor of the Bahamas.
I mean, I knew as a kid there was stuff to look for, but man, once I got to this age, I realized, man, I wish I was at 12 again, because I could spend the rest of my life right here on this spot. Literally. And there is so much in the world to look for. Now, you won't see me up there in New Jersey or Northern Ireland where it's freezing and 6-inch visibility. I love it out here. We got warm water, and we complain when we get less than 100-foot visibility out here. So it's wonderful.
Yeah, if you're going to hunt for buried treasure, that's a pretty good place to be hunting for it.
Absolutely. I will not be in Northern Ireland.
I just want to, I'll let you go, Carl, but I just want to ask one last question. Is that when you did present your wife, Gigi, with a 50-meter superyacht for her birthday present, what was her reaction?
Well, we were actually on a trip in Colorado. We were actually at Vail. And the night before, I said, you know, I'm going to take her to dinner. And I'm a jewelry guy. You know, I always buy Tiffany's, or, you know, I'm always buying watches or something. And we're at dinner. And I hand her a manila envelope to say happy birthday. And she kind of looks at me funny, like, where's the little green box? And she opens it up. And there is the ship used to be called Harmony. And I had taken it and scratched out Harmony of this picture and put Gigi underneath it. And so I don't think she really understood it. When she opened it, I thought she thought we were going to charter it. But when I told her that I had just purchased it, I think her chin hit the table. And, you know, that was really where everything began. And then we had never seen it. I had never even seen it. And so we get to Fort Lauderdale, and the whole crew's on there waiting for us. And we're standing at the bottom of the stairs, and I pull up, you know, a bow out of my pocket and stick it on the railing. And I said, happy birthday. And we walked up, and she was ours.
Amazing story. And from that one boat grew dozens more.
I mean, yeah, we got a few things floating these days. but it really takes a fleet to do what we're doing. And that's, you know, one of the important things was I'm a pretty good guy at, you know, chronology and how to put things together. This would have never happened without starting with the fleet and building it, because part of the way we got our license was to prove to the government that we had the equipment to pull this off.
Yeah. And that is the Allan Exploration Fleet, and it's quite the armada nowadays. And so how would you recommend people follow your adventures, Carl? There's been some great YouTube videos.
Yes, we do have a wonderful crew. We've got a neat video that just came out, Bahama Banks. It's on YouTube. It's about 20 minutes long, and it really kind of tells the story. You really ought to go check it out. Our website, of course. And then, you know, check out Fox News. I'm on there a lot. But we were on that big French TV, ITV or F1 or whatever that was. I just recently found out that 60 Minutes wants to do a segment. Very excited about that. We have a magazine out. Incredible man, Sean Kingsley, who I think you know, put out a magazine called, one of his editions called Shipwreck Watch. Wreck Watch. And it's totally dedicated, almost, with the exception of an article about sponge diving. It's almost all talks about Allan X, the Marine, or the Bahama Maritime Museum, and the salvage of the Maravillon. It's wonderful.
And of course, social media is a great place as well.
It's, you know, I always use it in business, but it amazes me, Stuart, how many people are into this. I mean, I can turn on a 5-year-old looking at treasure all the way to these 70-year-old billionaires, and I've done it. And they're fascinated by this. I mean, it's got everything. It's got the ocean. It's got shipwrecks. It's got the piracy aspect to it. You know, it's Disney. It's what it is. It's really what amazes me how this went global.
Yeah. Well, it's a brilliant story. And so, Carl, thank you for sharing it with us on the podcast. And it'd be great to catch up with you again soon.
Well, Stu, just in closing, I think you are the first podcast I ever did. I think that was 3 years ago now. And if you remember, I was hinting at this. I really wasn't blown, but you kept saying, what are you going to do with all this stuff? And I was like, well, we're going to look for old wooden ships and, you know, but your organization has been so good to me and my organization. And I thank you for following us and the articles you've done and these podcasts are wonderful. And I said earlier, Stuart, I always got time for you. As much as my wife wants to come to Europe, I'm sorry. I don't think I'm going to be able to make it. But boy, thank you so much for the invitation.
Absolute pleasure. Carl, thanks again, and speak again soon.
Okay. Thank you very much, Stuart. Good day to you, sir.
Thank you for listening to this week's Big Boat interview, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.